writers in the legal field, not very different from promoting Asian writers in the literary field, right? Like, the focus is still on our community.
Yeah.
And I think my heart's still there.
Yeah, just a little bit more on your work with Rice Paper then. If you don't mind me asking, well, how did you first get involved? How did you first meet Jim, and how did you kind of get closer as you continued working together?
I don't think I was supposed to. Like, so what happened was, back then, Rice Paper had a different editor, and my very good friend from my creative writing days from U of A, Hanako Masatani, she was working Rice Paper as a volunteer. And so she called me up out of the blue one day, because I had moved to Vancouver then, I was working my master's in publishing, and she said, hey, Rice Paper had a fire, come on down, we need your help. And I mean, the joke goes that I thought it was a literal fire, you know, bringing buckets and everything, but it turns out that the previous editor had run off with all the money and taken off the staff. So I think we were left with maybe four or five of volunteers, and when you consider initially you had about 40 volunteers, that's a huge difference. So, of course, you do not meet Jim anywhere other than a Chinese restaurant or a congee restaurant, and there was four or five of us sitting around the round table, and Jim just looked at me and said, okay, you're it. And I think the only reason is because I had this publishing thing I was studying, right? I wasn't even graduated at the point. And he's just said, okay, we need someone to get us started from the roots. So I wasn't an editor from the very beginning. My heart was in storytelling. It's always been because of the creative writing background. But Jim wasn't going to let me touch the editorial. I think he had learned the hard way that, you know, you need to have strong operations. So when I look back, he was very wise to do so, but back then I was resentful because it's, I mean, you're volunteering, and he said, okay, now you're going to do, you're going to be the business manager. And I'm thinking, what?
Yeah.
I have no clue how to run a business. Then after the business development phase, he said, okay, now you're going to do circulation. Now you're going to do advertising. So I pretty much did every single field while dabbling and working on editorial until the point he decided I was ready to be an editor-in-chief. And that took a while. So because the previous editor had absconded, there were a number of issues where he had completed but were not released onto newsstands yet. So we had to hold them and release them on the newsstands in bits and pieces, because we had to resolve certain issues with the printers and the funders and our like stakeholders. And I mean, now I guess it doesn't matter anymore, but back then it was a very sensitive topic. So interestingly, because of that little gap, right, so you would see like magazines released with his name on it, but that was a time when I was working with Jim operationally to get the magazine back on track behind the scenes. So by the time the first one was released with my name as an editor, several months, if not a whole year, had passed. And so the very first magazine was under my name was volume 8.4. So volumes 1, 2, 3 were with a different editor, and volume 8.4 is the first one that I wrote a co-editorial with Hanako Masatani. So we were both executive editors at that point, not EIC. And when you look at the 8.4 volume, you see a detraction from the previous issues. Back then, because Rice Paper was released as a print quarterly, we try to make sure every series, like volume 8, volume 7, etc., had a certain look, had a certain theme. Partly because Rice Paper started as a publication with rotating guest editors. So every editor wanted to put their imprint on it. And partly also because nobody really stayed that long. It was a volunteer-run organization, right? So the previous editor had a visual arts background. I think he was also a curator of sorts. So it was very interesting. He had a different vision, and he ran the magazine as though each issue was going to be an art gallery. So each issue had a theme. I think 8.1 was technology, 8.2 was a touch issue, 8.3 was colloquially known as a Hapa issue, but the tagline was, you know, end of pure race. So it was a little contentious. Anyways, we got some very interesting letters to the editor from that, which we had to sort out after. So when you look at 8.4, though, it gets away from this thematic issue, which is the one we started, and goes towards a more traditional magazine format. So it had things like, you know, clear front of the book, right? You have editorial, masthead, you have like columns, you have departments. So I introduced things like very clear delineation of every department had to represent a certain type of art. So you had performing arts, you had maybe theater, which is not the same as performing arts, because performing arts was a broader category for stand-up comedians, you know, spoken word, etc. You had a literary area. So literary was then split later in later years to fiction, nonfiction, poetry, etc. You had art news, which was Jim's way of connecting the entire community with what's going on in the world of Canadian Asian Canadian arts. And you had something called Coast to Coast, which was a collection of pictures from people from Victoria all the way to like PEI, Halifax, right? St. John's, saying these are things happening as Asian Canadians, what have we done? And so that very first issue was the start of this kind of look. And of course we had the features, right? And the features we had, I believe Roy Ma was featured for that very issue. And Roy Ma is a bit of a cultural hero, right? Because he's the person who basically said, hey, you know, Chinese who have never been able to vote deserve citizenship because we fought in the Canadian military in World War II, and, you know, down exclusion act, right? Give us our rights. And so he's a bit of a hero. So Rice Paper, even though it wasn't a very openly direct activist publication, there was always some element of soft activism. So when I say soft activism, I mean, it's not, you know, we're not going to publish an essay on maybe those topics, only on like Exclusion Act and head tax. But we will maybe publish an interview that, you know, is about a documentarian who's done work on this, right? Or maybe a feature on someone in the community who's done that. So I think a lot of those early years for me and Jim were about establishing that community and giving that visibility on the newsstands to people across Canada, because Rice Paper was distributed nationally. So I think when you see the shift on our covers, right, our covers started looking a lot less literary. We started featuring like a face each time. And the goal was to bring more prominent Asian Canadians into the cover. So for example, like in the years when I was editor, we had David Suzuki, we had Margaret Cho, you know, we had like Tommy Chong came after, we had Kate Rigg, you know, people that were already leading in the Asian Canadian community. And we then Jim and I thought, you know, it's good to give them that limelight. And at the same time, we also brought in the emerging artists, right? Because now that you have the people who are leading, more people want to be featured. So I think someone once said back in the days, you know, every great Asian Canadian artist starts out by being featured somewhere in Rice Paper. And that was kind of the intention to establish that. I think I've rambled on for a while. But
That's still really beautiful. I feel like I can see, especially like your storytelling background, how that kind of translates in how Rice Paper has evolved when you were executive editing and when you were EIC as well. In the panel, you kind of mentioned also a kind of like a predecessor to Rice Paper as well, which was the Asianadian, which I actually hadn't been familiar with. On top of like Asianadian, there were also like a few newspapers as well, I'm sure, like the Chinese Times. And I was just wondering if there were any direct influences or inspirations that you took in how you curated Rice Paper.
So Asianadian was published in, I think, in 1978, and I think it ran for 7 or 8 issues and ended in sometime in the 80s. So the founder is Chuck Wan. I know him out in Toronto. And I think he had a co-founder as well, so my apologies. I don't know who that was. But Asianadian was very much more of an activist publication. So there were a lot of issues back in the 70s, right? I mean, there was a Vietnam War, various other things going on as well. And I think they found it that it was a necessary publication to talk about these issues and bring all the Asian community together, because there wasn't an English publication. So I believe back then Chuck had actually said something about wanting to have a publication that was both in Mandarin and English. He thought, okay, let's do this. And he thought, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense, because if you can read English, you're not reading Mandarin, and vice versa. So they struck the Mandarin part and said, you know, all of us are people who speak English, there isn't really anything like this out there. We need a community and a forum. So I think over the years they had things like the youth issue, there was the LGBTQ plus issue, the themes, right? And I think every time there would be different guest editors, and they ran as an editorial collective. So that's the difference between Asianadian and Rice Paper, because I ran Rice Paper more like a business, because we were going for visibility, capacity building back in the day, right? And Asianadian was more a group of people of like mind getting together and saying, this is what this issue is going to look like. So the content was different because they were more focused on current affairs, nonfiction, essays, activism, right? Things affecting our community. And Rice Paper was more about literary arts and culture, which is why I insist on those departments being very clear. There should be one for music, theater, et cetera, so we don't forget any of the typical genres. But also, I don't think it's possible to talk about these things and address the Asian Canadian gaze without having some kind of activism there, because there's always the exploration of identity, where your culture is in this larger landscape that is Canada, right? So I would say the Rice Paper is more of a soft activism. The goal then was through entertaining and giving people a chance to write and maybe talking about important issues in a soft way, it's introducing and educating people in a way that is more palatable, right? If you're not of a mind to be a out there activist, because sometimes it can take a lot of courage to be an activist. We're saying, hey, by the way, we need room and we need to have a voice too.
I think that's especially important in the sphere of like a lot of anti-Asian sentiment at the time. It must have felt scary to be in that direct activism space. So I think it's very important that Rice Paper was doing that sort of work of self-activism too.
Yeah, Jim was very careful to not go too far into activism. There's nothing wrong with activism, right? To be clear. I think he just wanted to remember that there's activism and then there's culture development.
Yeah.
And you exist as a community and your culture is part of your community, right? But if no one's documenting and no one's allowing you the room to express yourself, then it's almost as though the culture doesn't quite exist. Mm-hmm. That was his view. And so I think Rice Paper existed for that purpose.
Yeah. So from the panel, you kind of talked a little bit about finding stories from that sort of tension between a story and its storyteller. And I was just wondering, in the process of choosing which works to get featured in Rice Paper, were there any particular authors or stories that were specifically true to this quote?
Yeah, so I think I'll talk a little bit about the process and now go into the quote part. So the process, I think a lot of the, when I, during the panel, I mentioned a lot of the times, the submissions that came in were of three kinds, right? Like usually there's identity searching, who am I, why am I here, why me, that kind of thing. That's important because, you know, that's very much part of the psyche of the community. But at the same time, I think Jim and I wanted the content to hit a couple points. Because our goal was to legitimize, document history, and then bring something that was a little bit more alternative, it's not that we're alternative, but just simply it wasn't documented a lot, into more of a mainstream awareness. And a lot of stuff that was coming in then wasn't necessarily always in publishable form, because if you're Asian, typically your parents will be telling you to become a doctor, lawyer, engineer, something. And so not a lot of us were going in and taking writing schools or, you know, visual artists. So I think when he and I went through the process of picking it, it was a combination of factors, right? You could either be, you know, in a form that is perfect because they're just a talented writer and great. But often that wasn't the case. And Jim would focus more on a good story. So I think that's where the tension quote comes in. So sometimes a person may come in with a very good story, or maybe they're a very interesting background, like a documentarian who's talking about something that has to be, you know, put out there, but no one's ever talked about it before. Maybe they're not the best writer, right? That has a lot of worth and merit. It goes in. Or it could be there's this new artiste who's developing a new form of art, and as it shows the development of these intersections of genres, that's interesting too, because it shows Asian Canadians are experimenting, so that would have some merit. History, so for example, I think we have Anna Mae Wong, right? She was like the original siren of this cinema in the 30s. We had like Long Tak Sam, who was a neuromancer. He was kind of like the Houdini of his times, but most people don't know about that. And Jim felt was very important to bring awareness, because he wanted to show that Asian Canadian culture wasn't just a thing from this century. It's been in North America for a long, long time, right? So it shows that history and longevity of how this culture has evolved, and that was important. So this combination of all these things, and as I said before, if it wasn't always in publishable format, then our mandate as a magazine also was to mentor writers and to help those voices develop. So this was where a lot of his mentoring worked with me. And I think because I was also trained as a writer, it was possible for me to figure out how to coax the story into life. Jim and I would sometimes have arguments about this, because he would say, okay, hey, make this happen. I was like, what, how? But anyway, I think sometimes when it comes to tension between the storyteller and the actual story, it may not be the story that the storyteller wants to tell or sets out to tell. There's a few things going on, right? Especially if you're editing a magazine. You need the story that you publish to be something that fits the mandate of your publication. Mm-hmm. You also need the story to at least be representative of the voice of the magazine. When I say voice, I don't mean Asian Canadian voice only, right? Though that's important. I meant every publication, like, for example, Esquire, Geist, GQ, etc. There's a certain voice that is prevalent throughout the entire magazine in terms of tone.
Yeah.
So that's also important. So you need to know if this writer is able to work with you on making that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also, you need to know if that story can be coaxed out, right? Maybe you're telling the writer, the story should be about A, and they're like, well, no, I want to tell B and only B.
Mm-hmm.
So that tension then becomes a tension between the writer and the editor as well. But it can be that tension that brings out the most interesting stories. So, for example, there was this filmmaker. She was native Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably one of the most compelling stories I've ever had the honor of editing. But so she had lived with her mixed heritage for her entire life. And I think when the story was submitted to us, it was in 2004, and she had just come out about her dual heritage in 2002, so that was a fairly recent thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very raw and sensitive topic, especially when you consider the natives and the Chinese, our history. It's not a very happy one, right? Because the natives had the Indian Act, we had the Exclusion Act, and basically you're talking about two marginalized communities with parallel suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And from her mom's side on native, her dad's side on Chinese, like, it's just a lot of suffering and silence. You got to treat this very delicately. And I think the story that came to us was maybe in a rougher form. It was beautiful, but it would have been akin to reading someone's stream of consciousness, slightly more structured, of course, than that, but
mm-hmm.
in someone's very private personal diaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as an editor, you have to ask yourself, right, is there is a narrative that has to be told with that.
Mm-hmm.
How do I honor that? How do I work with this person to develop that? And I think you also have to ask yourself, maybe it's better to leave an original format. Maybe the readers do want to read that, but then it may not go with what I said, the voice, the overall mm-hmm. tone of the magazine. Or maybe it's too raw, such that the readers would read it may not be as open and receptive to the topic as if we had taken some time to turn into a more fleshed out article in a different way, right? Because you always have to give some context of the history, where this person's coming from,
mm-hmm.
how the story developed. So there were three possible stories in this one. So for example, it could have been about her discovery of her duality and identity. It could have been about her seeking and trying to find her Chinese father.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been about coming to terms and accepting this about herself, like which other stories we have to tell. So many multiple possible tension points. Which one is it going to be the ultimate mm-hmm. story? In the end, it went with like her coming to terms, because one of the Rice Paper mandates also is about giving people hope, right? If you're getting our magazine and you live in rural PEI,
mm-hmm.
the idea is that you want to feel a little less alone, that someone has struggled with culture, identity, and that you are doing the same thing, but you can feel yourself reflected there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how we develop some of that. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. I think, especially knowing that, you know, the voice, I guess like the true heart of the magazine is to give hope. I think it's a beautiful sentiment to think about. How do you find that voice has changed over the years with Rice Paper when it first started out and, you know, now that it's, has changed a little bit since?
My, you just don't like to ask easy questions, do you? In the early days, a lot of what we dealt with was identity, right? Mm-hmm. Searching, where am I? Pulling the community together and raising our community up, right? Like, for example, one of the profiles on the covers. And I was reading the editorials, past editorials, and one of the editors after me, I believe Alan Cho was one of them. He did the editorial, I think, a few volumes after me, and he said that the change was not from just putting like more popular culture out there, right? Because we were trying to position Asian Canadian culture as part of a bigger mainstream. And he said, now we're in a position to put the best between our covers, mm-hmm. because we finally got to the point where there was critical mass, there were enough writers coming in of a certain caliber and standard. Mm-hmm. So I think that was one change. And then the other one would have been less articles on identity. I mean, of course, identity is still there, but it's less angsty. It's more about an inward seeking and then reflecting it outwards again. Whereas I think back then it was like a loud scream. Mm-hmm. Now it's more of a silent contemplation. Like that was where that evolution went. And now it's not even that. It's more of a, it's more subtle. So I think a lot of writing that came in back then was semi-autobiographical, mm-hmm. nonfiction, or very clearly fiction that was about these topics. Mm-hmm. It shifted away into more performance arts, right? Mm-hmm. So stories where they weren't necessarily about this, but identity is gently explored. Mm-hmm. So, for example, maybe articles about like colorblind casting. Mm-hmm. Why, you know, there was one of the articles was written about 45% of Canadians are minorities, mm-hmm. but maybe 3.2 to 6% are cast on stages and in TV. This is, bear mm-hmm. in mind, this is like mid-2000s. Mm-hmm. So articles that would just kind of gently talk around this, right? And that maybe we should be looking at casting more minorities, because even if it doesn't make sense from, you know, what you're used to, it makes sense from a capitalist point of view, because it's 45% of the market that you're, you know, excluding.
You're missing out,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. So now you don't have that, right? Like, mm-hmm. for example, we have things like Bridgerton out there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing. You can look at these people and be like, oh, there's a black person, there's an Asian person in, like, Regency, you know, mm-hmm. England. You know, beautiful costumes aside, I'm just going to watch it just because it almost feels like something that Jim would have been dreaming of back then. Or things like you have, like, K-pop Demon Hunters.
Ooh, yeah.
Right? Seeing mm-hmm. on manga and big screen, someone eating kimbap, right, with Asian eyes, like East Asian eyes, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's just, it's got its place now, mm-hmm. right? Rice paper used to be more like a political statement saying, oh, I exist. Now it's more of a, hey, this is where you get your great start and this is where we feature great art.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a shift. And also you see a lot more genre type writing as well. So like, here's an example, right? Like, just look at the list that CBC gave this year of like 40 Asian Canadian writers to look out for.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have like the Oxford Soju Club by Jin-Woo Park. He's mm-hmm. actually one of our Rice Paper editors now.
Oh.
It's a spy novel mm-hmm. that talks about the Korean diaspora.
Oh.
And I think Jin-Woo was saying that because as a spy, you have to take on a different persona and blend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do that all the time as minorities because, you know, you don't want to stand out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about addressing identity in a different way, right? That's one very, very good example of it. You have Canon by Li Lai, right, which is a graphic novel. You have Dystopian Fiction, which is Wonderland Road by Carrie Ann Leong,
yeah.
right? You have, let me see, The Hunger We Pass Down by Jin Suk Fong Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a horror-tinged, transgendered saga, right? That talks about how the protagonist's doppelganger forces her to confront the legacy of violence in her family.
Mm-hmm.
So very identity, very culture-based, but in a horror-type genre. So not something we would have seen back then. And then, like, we have Ramin Abbas Has Major Questions by Ahmad Saber.
Mm-hmm.
So that was LGBTQ plus novels, right? Also something that would not have been that much in, published, I guess, in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
So we've come a really, really long way, because we're no longer just talking about identity head-on. We're talking about it with the sophistication of knowing that we have a place in other genres.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess from that, what do you hope will develop from the Asian literary landscape now?
I guess the sky's the limit, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Right? I mean, more of this, clearly. I think early on, and I do remember this, so one of the things that Jim set out to do wasn't just Rice Paper, right? Because Rice Paper was a vehicle to publish Asian Canadian literature. He also has things like, you know, Emerging Writers Award to promote writing. As you know, Rice Paper, ACWW, they publish anthologies of, you know, writing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's also Literation, which you're aware of, right? A festival to keep promoting awareness on Asian Canadian literature. So back in the day, I remember sometimes we would approach publishers who would see Asian Canadian literature as a sellable subgenre.
Oh.
But they will want the submissions to be couched in history.
Oh.
So they'll tell our writers, write, but I want it to be a history about Asian Canadian history, and you can set the novel there. Or it has to be about identity and a certain exoticism.
Mm-hmm.
But that's no longer the case, right? Because you're seeing things like, you know, what I just described to you, different genre specific. So it's basically there's a lens of Asian Canadian perspective, but at the same time in different genres.
Mm-hmm.
And I think mixed genres would be very exciting. If it's not just in writing, it could be performance art mixed with something else, like visual art, mm-hmm. right? Honestly, I'm very excited and very curious because it hasn't even taken us that long to get here, if you think about it. Yeah, I mean, we're very good at being creative and developing very quickly. We have a lot of expertise in the community, right? So,
and it's interesting to learn like how that creativity was limited initially, like being forced to write for history, for example. I would imagine that's very limiting to a lot of writers.
Yeah, or it could be freeing to some people, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, if you think about it, if you're a journalist, you're usually given a topic anyway.
Yeah.
You have to be a workaday writer in some sense. So, you know, there's that. But I think a lot of it is well-intentioned. Mm-hmm. It's just now you know it's marketable, and you know that these writers are not going to really not sell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no, that's a double negative. But you know that there is a commercial market for this kind of work, which also puts it on the mainstream market. And it's also a chance to use the same content and multiply it tenfold, right? You could have a podcast on the story. You could have a novel. You can have a play on it. And if you multiply it tenfold in different formats, then you increase the chances of it reaching a greater audience.
Mm.
I mean, nowadays, I think there's just so much content out there, right?
Mm.
Especially with AI and algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
So the focus is on superficial consumption and like an echo chamber. So when you take your produced art and put it into human hands, so for example, like festivals, spoken word, which isn't just an algorithm, I think that pushes the boundaries a little bit more, or at least it reminds people, hey, it's not just something electronically produced, right? And then when people are exposed to other human-created art, you develop and work on it, right? It's a cycle. It keeps building.
Yeah, I guess in that sort of note, as a closing question, in this new age where mediums such as literary magazines are, you know, getting lost, there's a lot of issues with, like, budget limitations now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting outcompeted with, like, different forms of media, especially, like, digital social media platforms. What do you find could play as, like, the biggest threats to the wider literary landscape? And also on top of that, how can we adapt and or support that?
I think I touched on the threat a little bit earlier, right? The algorithms, the fact that attention spans are shorter. For example, you can take, you know, maybe a literary novel and then rewrite some of the content for a shorter attention span type thing. Like maybe instead of a whole length novel, you have like a novella. And maybe novella can be disseminated electronically in a certain way, right? You can act it out. Right? Or it could be a podcast where you talk about certain stories, about a character. You have spin-offs, right? So there's a novel part, and then there's, you know, this character, and you follow him in a supporting storyline that's shorter for the tension. And that can also drive readers towards the main work. I think it's about understanding that there's actually more options than ever, and we don't need someone to be, oh, hey, I'm the publisher, I'm sitting in my ivory tower, I'm going to approve your work.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually self-publish. So that actually, in some ways, is not a threat. It's about trying to compete with all the other noise out there. So you just got to make sure your noise is repetitive or is better. So there's one thing. I think the other thing is marginalized voices. I guess the worst thing really would be, the worst threat would be to give up, right?
Yeah.
Just to stop. And if anything, Jim Wong Chu showed us, we should just keep going even when the going gets rough. So as long as there's a community, and as long as you build your village of all these voices, I think to some degree, larger or smaller, you make sure that the voices continue to be heard. And in terms of practical things, what I would say, right, like encourage community sponsorships, community grants, try to take things away from the big corporate. Not that they're bad, but it's just if the community is sponsoring something and you're not looking at it from how much commercial success something's going to be, then it's about just getting a volume work out there, making it possible for someone to produce work.
Thank you to Florentina and to Jessica Chan for that interview. You can find that whole thing posted at cgsf.ca. Stick around today. We got Democracy Now! Coming up next, and then the whole day on Thursday is a blast. If you want to come by the station, we got Record Club today at 4. We're talking about emo. But on the air, we got The Art Show. We got Call Me Negotiator. We got Free Voices. We got Analog Archives. We got Wham Bam East Van. We got The George Bastian Show. We got Beats and Eats. So much cool, great stuff coming up today on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thanks for listening. Couldn't do it without you.